take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Mr. Morale, give me high five. 2 times in a code of finish, judging my life. Backpedaler, what they say you do to cha-cha.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast. Your non-resistance is the key to the greatest power in the universe of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Garamonica.
CC, wait a minute. Ben-a-key, c'est la vie. I tell the whole truth from A to Z.
We're talking Kendrick today. We have an incredible squad. I want to open by saying I was emailing with Craig Jenkins, who's here with us, and Craig told me earlier this week that he did all the Eckhart reading before getting into the Kendrick album. And I had to be honest and say that I did.
I did a bit.
There's a lot to read. But I had to be frank.
I put in a lot of chapters.
I did not do the Eckhart reading. But in preparation for this, I busted out A New Earth, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose. Who among us has not had an Eckhart Tolle phase? Certainly I have.
Mine started last weekend.
Yeah. And Kendrick's been on a mission, apparently, for a few years. So my opening salvo, that was a quote. And to be honest, as I get older, I do find that non-resistance is, in fact, the enlightened path. So go off, Eckhart, I guess. We have a big talk today. Like I said, Craig Jenkins here, music critic at Vulture, and also, we haven't had Craig on since he was a finalist for the 2021 Pulitzer Prize in Criticism.
Thank you.
Hello, Craig.
What's up?
Jeffy Haza is here from Rolling Stone, senior editor of Rolling Stone. What's up, Jeff?
Hello.
Back 9 months after dropping a Rihanna Rocky Baby on the Drake cast. Now the baby is here and Jeff is back. We appreciate it.
He is risen.
Real talk. And rounding it out, Stephen Kearse is here. Stephen is a contributing editor at The Nation and writes for Pitchfork and others. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, happy to be here. It's my first time.
I know, pumped. Everybody here reviewed the Kendrick album. And I will say 3 out of 4 rap critics agree Kendrick is, quote, fallible on this record. When you read all of our reviews, that word does come up. And obviously, part of the reason that comes up is because we are living, but there's two things. One part of it is Kendrick specific. One part of it is, I think, the era that we are in. Kendrick, I think, is often mistaken as a paragon of moral virtue by really dedicated fans. I think sometimes that presentation is imposed upon him. And we are also in a time, whether it's Kendrick, Beyonce, Rihanna, Taylor, where certain stars are elevated to this kind of infallible place. And yet, here is Kendrick on this album, Mr. Morale and the Big Steppers, his 5th album, very, very pointedly shaking off anyone's desire for him to be infallible. Craig, were you struck by that? Because coming off of Butterfly and Damn, which are both extraordinarily confident records in different ways, this really does feel like a pivot thematically and tonally.
You know, he's telling us a lot of stuff that we already knew about him. We already knew that he was not your perfect rapper and that kind of a lot of that smoke was foisted on him and he felt really weird about it. It's always kind of been in the margins, but it's never been like, it's never peppered the album the way that it does this one.
Jeff, what do you think about that? Because I feel like Craig's right in the sense that Kendrick lets people know that he goes through things or lets people know that he does feel fallible in a way, but I feel like that's never defined his narrative.
Well, yeah, and it's always kind of like been a bit odd to me as a Kendrick skeptic, I guess you could call it, where like, you know, this whole time I've been one of those people who's like, I would never say Kendrick Lamar is a bad rapper. You know, that's a horrible, dumb thing to say. But it sounds like you, it's like, the idea of like calling him anything other than the greatest rapper for the past, you know, decade or so or whatever has felt like this sin in front of so many people. And so I feel like to me, it's always been really obvious. And it's like even in the work, he's not trying very hard to even say much more than how fallible he is. You know, something I was thinking about in terms of this review was going back to Swimming Pools and how when that song came out, you know, there's so much critical adoration around how he turned alcoholism into this metaphor that you could dance to. And I always just like think back on that, like, we really convince ourselves sometimes with Kendrick specifically that he is the first person to have come up with an idea.
Right. Or the first person to have rapped with certain cadences, the first person. Like, one of the things that I always find strange about the Kendrick narrative is obviously if you look at the long arc of Los Angeles underground hip hop dating back to the 90s, there's a bounty of rappers, Project Blowed Scene, Freestyle Fellowship, etc. There are people who rapped in the specific way that Kendrick raps. But I think sometimes generationally that stuff gets totally lost. So I think there are a lot of fans for whom I think Kendrick really is the gateway into that kind of artistry. And it's hard to like untether those folks, I think, sometimes from that idea. Stephen, what do you make of Kendrick in terms of personal politics on this record? And do you feel that there's a shift in how he's representing himself versus what he was doing on Damn and Butterfly?
I don't think there's a shift. I think there's a tonal switch. There's more emphasis on things. But even just going back to like Section 80 on like Absol outro, he says, I'm not the next pop star. I'm not the next socially conscious rapper. I'm Kendrick Lamar and I rap over dope beats. And I mean, he's definitely pushing back against his decade, really, like from Good Kid, Mad City to this record where he has improved as an artist, but the expectations have really grown. And I think this record is almost like, I don't want to say a tantrum because that sounds messy, but it's like staged that way. It's like, hey, you need to back up off me. And it's kind of abrasive if you weren't expecting it, but it is consistent with who he's been, I think.
Let me ask this. Who put this on Kendrick? Because if Kendrick, as far back as you say, as Section 80, was saying, I am not this guy, who put this on Kendrick? Because he clearly feels put upon.
It's his own smoke, though. Like, this is a guy who after the Mike Brown thing happened, was like, you know, we really got to care about, you know, the community also ourselves if we expect anybody else to. This is a guy who made the Black of the Berry. Like, so it's not that, like, all this stuff has been foisted on him. With regard to the history of the kind of rapper that he is, there's a lot of people who are involved in hip hop right now who are interested in the stuff who were not around in 2007 listening to the stuff. So like anytime the history goes missing, it's that there are people who got into Kanye two albums ago. And, you know, everyone just doesn't have the same attitude. That's why I'm always bringing stuff up, trying to dig into the history. Called him a 90s rapper. Would love to have heard a conversation between Kendrick and Prodigy or Kendrick and RZA. That's the type of guy that I see him as. But, you know, so like the moralist thing has always been there, you know, and maybe he gets really quiet for a long time and that sort of legend grows. But he's definitely killing a monster that he created on this album, I feel like, in part. As you know, we're responsible, but like, where do we get those inklings from except from the social justice narratives in the music, you know?
Let me ask this question, because this is something that's been on my mind. When you think of imagery and presentation, one of the things that's always been the case with Kendrick is he almost presents as kind of an ascetic. Certainly when you contrast him with the other stars of the era, whether it's Drake, I mean, obviously Cole is a complicated figure, but in that troika, I think Kendrick scans as the ascetic. Do you think that part of the moral valence of that is really what has formed the narrative around him, that people see Kendrick as an anti or a resistor to some other dominant narrative through lines in the genre?
He seems to be staging an anti-career. Like, he's been the least present that you could possibly be in that station, in the station of, you know, a person trying to put hits through on the radio every now and then, or, you know, sell a lot of records. He's been a ghost. And this is like, kind of the I'm coming back to explain why I haven't been here and then get back to it kind of record, I feel like.
I feel like Kendrick and Eminem have a very similar appeal to a very similar demographic of people.
This is the nuclear skeptic take.
Incredible. Incredible. We can literally end the show. We can end the show at that take.
Not for nothing. There's something to be said for the way that he sort of gets really crazy about cadences and stuff.
Oh, yeah. To that point, we opened the show. We were listening to Savior at the beginning of the show. And I think that really does encapsulate some of the themes that we're talking about. And also this cadence thing that both Jeff and Craig are bringing up. You want to expand on that, Jeff, a little bit? Like, talk to me a little bit about this evil Janus, this evil two-headed Janus of rap gods.
Well, I mean, he even nods to him a lot. But I feel like in kind of what you described, Craig, of like, you know, there's this sort of hip hop fan that is anti whatever is the kind of mainstream of what rap music looks like. And I think to a lot of people, that's your Drakes, that's your Kanye's, whatever. And both Eminem and Kendrick sort of traffic in this mistrust of narrative, mistrust of the government. I feel like there's something bigger going on, even when he kind of switches into that like country cadence. I'm like, Kendrick knows like low key that this is going to hit for like a certain, you know, Chet Hanks kind of guy.
there's a couple of moments on that record where he's like trying to poke a specific type of guy, and I think it's funny that, you know, that he would think that would be the audience.
I mean, white people love Kendrick,
but that's what I'm saying. But do you think that that's an accurate apprehension of his audience?
He dropped the Black of the Berry on their heads and they ate it. Like, they still consider it to be one of the best albums. So like, what really is there to push back against is how I feel.
This also came up in Charles Holmes's piece for The Ringer, shout out Charles, where he talked a lot about this, especially, you know, going back to Butterfly, especially Kendrick kind of finding his way through grappling with his relationship with white fans and also white women on this album. This is something that he returns to on at least two, maybe three songs. Does it feel like this is a person who is now second guessing the audience that has found him over the last few years?
It definitely has like the Atlanta Seasons, like, now we are going to talk a lot, perhaps too much, about the white gaze thing going on. There's an awareness of who could be listening and what they might get from it. That's like, I feel like the least essential stuff on the record, because I don't know, there's just so much more that's fascinating than like whatever, you know, percentage of people who are going to listen to the thing and be mad. Like, whoever this, we're probably going to be talking about this Grammy time next year. Like, what's really the smoke?
Steven, what do you make of the conversations about family on this record? Because obviously we have to, let's actually listen to a tiny bit of Father Time. Without a father, I salute you. May your blessings be neutral to your toddlers. It's crucial. They can't stop us if we see the mistakes. Till then, let's give the women a break. Grown men with daddy issues. So we have two songs. We have Father Time, and then towards the end of the record, we have Mother, I Sober. You know, if we're going to think about how the record is framed and Kendrick's conversation about what he inherited from his parents spiritually, what do you make of how he understands himself through the lens of his parents on this album?
I think he's really, since Good Kid, Mad City, I feel like he's been turning like further inward. And I feel like there's fewer voices on this record compared to just like past stuff. You know, there's not like voicemails and skits and all these things. And if they are there, they're just like really at the margins of the songs. And the family stuff is the richest stuff, because I think that even when it's clunky, like Auntie Diaries, it's still him kind of trying to understand himself through his family. And that's kind of where his best stuff is at. Like, I think what doesn't work here for me is that his writing just isn't as scenic as it used to be. And like, Kendrick's always been in his mind, but I feel like on this record, we spend a lot of time in his mind and we're not getting those like images, you know,
narratives. Yeah.
Like, he has that one moment on Auntie Diaries where he talks about his uncle pulling up, picking him up from school, and then they pull off with like DJ Quick playing. And I'm like, where's that? You know, like, there's so many moments throughout the Kendrick catalog that just feel vivid in that way.
Suppose he's just been in the house and that's just what it is.
Right. He's just on his beach cruiser. He's just like, every day he takes out a new beach cruiser. So it's like,
isn't like Argentina or something. I think he's got a verse on there. He talks about he essentially was in Argentina when the uprising happened.
No, that was, I think that's on the Heart Part 5. He talks about being in Argentina, presumably on tour, when Nipsey Hussle was killed.
Right.
Stephen, to your point, I do think like a lot of the best writing on this record comes in the family related stuff. It's forcing this perspective of let me detail actual stories, actual things that presumably actual things that he went through. And when we're kind of like telescoping out to bigger picture questions and other subjects, that's to me where the writing does get less specific and less compelling. Craig, what do you make of that? Do you agree with that? And then also, what do you make of the kind of two sides of the record, the really personal and the kind of like big idea record?
I am still, after having written 2,000, over 2,000 words about it, like kind of mixed up about it. I don't really know, like, the really narrative intensive stuff is like, I guess, objectively granular writing, but that's, I don't want to hear that stuff. Like,
really?
Those aren't really the songs. I mean, like on this particular record, that stuff, that's not the stuff that's interesting to me. It's like,
okay. But do you like it on the earlier records? Like, do you like it on Good Kid, Mad City?
It's compelling there. Yeah. You know, I guess if Father Time counts as the family stuff in like really narrative intensive, then I really like that one. But it's mostly thanks to the Sampha part.
I was going to say, I didn't really like the Sampha sample.
I also don't like the Sampha part. I was like, you have Sampha and it's, to me, it's not super effective. Also, I also felt the same way about Beth Gibbons. I hate to say, I might be out on an island on that one.
You know, I heard it and I was like, I would do something different with her.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, one track that I feel like is, to me, the biggest miss in terms of the more personal stuff is We Cry Together, the literal stage opera.
I don't know how much of a clean version exists of We Cry Together. So I want to preface this by saying we're going to play something right now. I cannot speculate how many bleeps.
An alchemist beat.
Yeah, exactly. It might just be an instrumental. I don't know. But here is some TBD part of We Cry Together.
Confrontational, dumb. You wanna bring it down. Even when I'm trying to do right, we can go our separate ways right now. You can move on with your life. I swear to God.
You love a pity party. I won't show up. Always act.
Okay, Jeff, go in on that because I feel a little differently about it, but I want to hear this perspective.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You guys have been talking about like just how compelling do we find is the more personal writing that he's kind of diving into. And I think with We Cry Together, you know, you can't imagine a more obvious take. That's just kind of the way that I tried listening to it in like a million different ways and like headspaces. And it's like, it always lands at like really dumb SNL skit. Like it always lands at.
It gave me Biggie skit first album.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas like, this is like, oh, let me get like so-and-so and then we're going to act out like what we think, which is great if you're like 16 or something, but like, I don't know, something about that record on this album in the context almost felt like, do you just think you could just, you know, fart on a track and like put it out? Like, I don't know. Something about it was like crazy to me that like that was okay to people.
I want to find out, Stephen, what do you make of We Cry Together? What do you make of this?
I don't love it, but I respect it. And I also think that like in terms of Kendrick trying to be like, hey, this is what I listen to. This is what I'm into. He's like, hey, I'm a John Singleton guy. You guys gave me a Pulitzer, but like,
wow.
I watch Baby Boy and
Martin. It is Singleton.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
And I feel like, wow. I kind of, but even that.
It feels Hamilton. It feels like, oh, like when Miranda does Baby Boy.
No.
Jeff, wildly.
Because like the part where she's like, she's rapping through tears, like that part for me, I'm just like, yo.
She's not a rapper though. That's incredible. I feel like
that is crazy. It is crazy. It is crazy that Taylor Page like really took it there. Like, shout to her for like getting probably the wildest script she'll ever get and just taking it.
And she was in Zola.
She can only go up from here.
Craig, what do you make of We Cry Together?
I have completed my contract with it and I'm not needed anymore.
Okay. Can I have like a potentially like strange take on this song, which is on a record that to me has a lot of musical misses, a lot of kind of like scrambling things, like things that don't feel totally focused, even though there are individual sections and moments that I really like. We Cry Together, in its bluntness, somehow feels among the more musically coherent and successful songs on this record, Hamilton aside.
Like, imagine a Griselda guy on that record, like, who's supposed yes. to be on that sound, like.
Mm.
How would you feel if it was We Cry Together, the exact same song, but it was West Side Gun instead of Kendrick, but the everything else is the same?
Let's be honest, it was slam.
That'd be crazy.
And while we're on the topic, I feel like Worldwide Steppers is a Billy Woods record. He's there's definitely wow. like influenced stuff happening. Like, he's listening to a lot of guys we don't give him credit for listening to, I think.
One of the things on the album is, like, sonically, especially the first half, I thought this is some of the most interesting sounds I've heard on a major label album in the past few years. From just the transition, even from the opening into the first three, really. Because he's got, like, a very, like, coherent thing going on.
Who's at Hamilton? Let's, like, really talk about that. Because it's not the first time that, like, I heard somebody compare it to Hamilton. And I feel like we're using, like, a very specific, like, that is a specific shorthand. Like, yes, there is a lot of, like, there's a lot of live instruments happening and, like, very earnest and emotional performances. But that can go, like, 100 ways.
Yeah, I wouldn't compare it to Hamilton.
How do you mean it, Jeff? You mean it in the most insulting way.
No, I think, to me, it's, like, it's hard to listen to that and not feel as though it is like a theater production mimicking rap versus the other way around. You know, like, it doesn't feel like a skit on a rap album. It feels like an interlude in a play that's trying to be, like, progressive.
But are Kendrick albums not plays? Like, is that not kind of a motif?
This guy wrote a song where he meets the Lord dressed as a beggar. So, like,
yeah, he's very theatrical, generally.
No, I mean, that's the thing with this whole album. Honestly, it's like, I think this is Kendrick at his most literal. And throughout the album, I mean, we were talking about Father Time a second ago, and that is another song that just annoys me, because it's like, at a certain point, you go from interesting metaphor about father issues to just outright saying, I have daddy issues. And I feel like that's where a lot of it ends up landing, where it's like, on top of the fact that you're already doing something a little bit on the edge of cringe with just, like, kind of this whole theatrical vibe that he's been on.
The whole thing is on the precipice of cringe. But, like, he's, like, he's trying to get quotables now. And you can't have the whole thing be esoteric and also have people saying it outside. I don't think that this is necessarily his most rap-intensive record. Some of his stuff is, but some of it is, like, I just want to get lines out.
Obviously, the shift from Butterfly to Damn is there is a terser, more focused, more, like, ostensible, broadly palatable packaging of the songs on Damn. It's not as esoteric musically. It's not as spacey. It's more concentrated. This feels like we're letting all that go. That's gone. We're back in the woods. We're doing this. I don't know if it's the psychedelics or what, but, you know, like, we're completely back in the woods now.
It feels like it's there, but he's trying to sabotage it.
It makes me think of Donda 2.
Everything is too slow for
okay,
the radio.
Okay, Jeff, you're getting ahead of my last question. Save that. Do you think that Kendrick understands himself as a hyper-lyric? Like, how important are bars to Kendrick, like, in your opinion?
This man said sciatica nerve. I don't know how to feel. That's like, he's, like, up there with the Project Blowed guys, like, he's
yeah, it's like a that's a Razzcast lyric. It's a Razzcast lyric.
You get it.
Shout out Razzcast.
Is Auntie Diaries Nature the Threat then?
Yeah, well, I mean, okay. That is a great way to enter into the Auntie Diaries discourse. Obviously, the way y'all feel about We Cry Together, I think maybe we all of us feel about Auntie Diaries. Is there any of the four of us writing for Auntie Diaries?
I mean, that's where the Eminem metaphor really comes home for me.
It's not even a metaphor. It's just like that. Here's another guy trying to reclaim a word that doesn't belong to him. You've been through this cycle before. This time, nobody cares, though. Like, last time, like, Eminem had to go on and talk to Anderson Cooper. I don't see that in Kendrick's future. And so it's really funny for this record to be like, cancel culture is a big thing when, like, you've just slid on something no rapper previous to you could ever. Like, fascinating perspective, I think.
We have no way of knowing this, but, like, dead naming, misgendering, is this something that we're sensing that Kendrick knew was a thing, understood what he was doing, and made those choices anyway? Or is this the work of someone who is not fully immersed in that discourse?
I don't know. I feel like I don't know where people get information generally, but there's still like a main street and like, and people know things. And it, and just like considering the rest of the record where he is being inflammatory and abrasive and confrontational, I think that that Auntie Diaries fits into that. You know, like a generous interpretation of that song is that Kendrick is talking about the ways, or trying to talk about the ways in which people are introduced to queerness in ways that are like still kind of like contiguous with their community. So like when he talks about his uncle being confusing to his friends and him having like an explanation for that. But then I'm just like, what? I don't need pedantic songs, you know? Like it reminded me of like Immortal Technique's like Dance with the Devil.
Hamilton, Immortal Technique. Man, this is this is rough. Wait, do we just not like Kendrick?
This is a son to Prince Paul's Psychoanalysis. What is it? If we're getting really obscure conceptually.
Although that record, a more thoroughgoing, coherent conceptual album than this record.
How about that? For what it's worth. It can be done.
It
can be done.
To go back to your question, I mean, I like Kendrick. I don't grade Kendrick on a curve. Like the way I think about Kendrick is like, okay, this album came out like last Friday. I listened to like five other albums that Friday. Like Kendrick is culturally like a juggernaut, but I think the mistake with Kendrick is to truly believe that he is on the mountain. And we see in this album that it's impacting his music making too, right? He has to shift the perception. And I'm like, I don't have that perception, you know?
Just out of curiosity, what of those six albums total was the best album that you listened to?
Quelle Chris, Death Fame.
Wow. Okay, this is, we really...
I'm not trying. All right, I said that.
No, I'm going to go get my backpack. I my backpack's in the other room. I'm just going to go get it.
I'm not like some super backpacker. That was just like in that particular crop.
Everyone in here is coming off the way. We've name checked all the tells.
We've really done it. Like, who are we fooling? Like that's absolutely true. Like the backpack card is it's valid for five more years after this episode of the podcast. Like we're all allowed at Tramps and SOBs. Like, we can go reopen Tramps and ourselves.
Oh my god!
Like we're good.
I'll get back to SOB someday.
Yeah, someday. Yeah. Shout out Junior. Shout out my guy Junior. All right, let's take a break for a minute, and then we will come back with more Kendrick talk.
Taking my baby to school, then I pray for, cause you they never been cool, writing testament, painting pictures, put me in the Louvre, that's a definite universal shift, I'm in the groove, a celebrity do not mean integrity, you fool, I'm a good man, shake your hand, firm grip rule, 72 wins, lost 10, balling with the flu, more than 2 M's, for sure, but add another 2, little man, the big man's the GT.
Craft matters, in small ways, like how coffee is made. Or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
We're back. Craig Jenkins is here. Stephen Kearse is here. Jeffy Haza is here. We're talking Kendrick. Stephen, you had mentioned before the break, the mountain. And you know, Kendrick is very direct on this record. I was struck on the two different songs where one, he's saying, I can't please everybody over and over and over again. The other one is, I choose me, I'm sorry, over and over and over again. Now, there's two ways to read those pleas, for lack of a better way of putting it. One, you, the fans, have like imposed this burden of like moral savior upon me, and I wish to deny it. I would like to be, what did Taylor say? Excluded from this narrative. He would like to be excluded from the narrative, right? That's part of it. The other thing, and Jeff, you touched on this briefly, here is a man who is clearly going through relationship struggles, individual relationship struggles. His partner is a kind of choral figure on this album. Depending how you read Mother I Sober, maybe they're not together anymore, although her Instagram seems to indicate that they are. How do you read those sentiments, Jeff? This I can't please, I choose me. Do you read that as a global sentiment, or do you read that as like an individual begging for mercy for or from his partner?
I feel like this is, and I feel like we'll find out in the tabloids in a few months.
We'll find out in Bossip.
In Bossip or something. If something of like this is true for Drake, but I feel like between Drake, Kanye, and now Kendrick, everything is giving divorce album. It's very much like, I've become untethered because my lady's gone. What do I do? And it's like, there are so many moments here where it's like, wow, replace Kendrick with Kanye right now. And it's just like trying to find myself because I lost my Kim. And I don't know, it kind of, to me, it has this sort of hollow disappointment where it's like, oh yeah, all these guys are just kind of like
wife guys.
Yeah. Like just wife guys who like kind of blow it.
I mean, I feel your cynicism and your fatigue, Jeff, but I don't know. I'm just like, yeah. I don't mind rappers being whiny or being like sad in their feelings. I want that. I just think, to me, the failure of this album, or not the failure, because it still has its high marks. The least interesting things about this are that there's just no push. There's no like drive. Like there's some energy pulsing through To Pimp a Butterfly and Damn and Good Kid, Mad City and even Section 80. And I just don't feel that here. There's a lot of just kind of reservation, sighing, and it just doesn't engage the music.
Let me ask this though, Stephen, do you think, especially regards to Butterfly and Damn, I think, do you think that some of that has to do with, frankly, just a more coherent musical package than what's on this album? A more consistent musical package?
I don't think so, because I think maybe like in the coming weeks, if there's any type of coverage of like the sessions, we'll have a better sense of how these came together. But I think that this has like an aesthetic personality that's pretty consistent. Like you look at the producer list and there's fewer familiar names or old names.
Right. Soundwave is here. Dahi is here. Obviously longtime collaborators, but there's new folks. Duval Timothy is someone who's on this record, piano player, who's very good. I think, Greg, maybe you mentioned Duval Timothy in your review or maybe on Twitter.
Yes, snapped on all the piano parts.
Yeah, he really did.
Really good.
The big instrumental stuff.
The album sounds really good on like hi-fi speakers. I was trying to find a way to say this without sounding like a weirdo, but like I really feel like there's something about the warmth in a lot of the sounds on the album that I actually do really appreciate. It almost makes the lyrics that much more frustrating, where it's like, this sounds really great. He just kind of didn't say that.
Oh, man. Could we talk just for a moment about some of the maybe less successful songs on this record? Like, I think about Die Hard or even Crown. They feel really undercooked, especially with some of the richness and storytelling with some of the family-oriented stuff. When we're kind of moving in the realm of abstraction and this kind of like big picture anxiety, it's sort of where it starts to fall apart for me a little bit.
I think Die Hard knocks. It was one of those songs. Yeah. I mean, I don't.
Interesting.
The way I kind of think about this album is like, I don't necessarily like this, but like this conceptually, or even just like on a like sensual level, this or like sensory level, I feel it. And I feel like Die Hard is one of those songs. I don't even love like Blessed, but I did like the other guest vocalist. What's her name?
Amanda Reaver.
Yeah, I thought I'm interested in what she does next. Honestly, that song reminded me of Hit-Boy's beats on King's Disease.
Interesting.
That song is very like mannered, and like anybody could have written it and it could have fit into any record. Like it's pleasant, but it just doesn't feel like it's batting with the same like verve that the others are.
It doesn't feel Kendricky, as awful as that sounds.
There are a couple of moments like that too. where it's like, it's kind of like just to prove that we can have some songs that are going to stream. Like, I feel like Silent Hill kind of gives that.
I think Rich Spirit has that energy, but it's also like a like
Rich Spirit for like, sure.
Unnervingly quiet for a record that sounds like it's going to be a Ty Dolla $ign kind of joint. Like, he's complicating, I feel like, the easy like hits on this record. And I really find that interesting because it begs the question of whether he even wants this stuff on the radio or whether he cares. I think a lot of stuff is going to end up on the radio just by force of personality and by force of interest. But if this is a new artist, a lot of this stuff was not flying. Structurally, I mean, like structurally.
Can we talk about the guests a little bit? We haven't quite arrived at the Kodak discourse, but I do want to say I like the Ghostface verse on Purple Hearts and Summer Walker, too, for that matter. But let's listen to a little bit of the Ghostface verse on Purple Hearts.
Telekinesis, I'm purifying these deep speeches. While I'm crying, I clean the feet of the sweet Jesus. Dreams, visions get blurrier, the Elohim is light. It's known to tear retinas in a single gleam. Shut the up. When you hear his love talking to the mind, is God's cipher.
You guys were talking earlier about like Kendrick as a 90s rapper, and I'd love to hear Kendrick in discourse with Prodigy or so ever. My take on that is I'd love to hear modern Kendrick in discourse with like 1995, 1996 Ghostface or Ray. That to me feels like super productive. It's interesting that Ghostface shows up on this record with, frankly, like a rather astonishing verse, like a really raw, tight, astonishing verse. I was really grateful to hear Ghostface in this mode again.
Yeah, I heard that Ghostface verse and I was like, oh, do I need to listen to that Bad, Bad, Not Good record? Because I I did not like that record. But he was like in a similar mode, kind of weepy, kind of in his feels.
Made me think of the song he did with Neo forever ago.
Oh, was that off Ghost Didi?
What was it called?
It's off Fish Scale. Back like that. Back like that. Yeah. It's like basically she starts like seeing an op. But it, like I always love that song because it's like Ghostface getting as close as he could at the time to being sensitive. And it's like cool to hear now, like a little bit more maturity there.
I like him on the Kendrick record because in just a very short span of time, things go really cosmic. Last year, the year before, I was able to talk to Ghostface for like just a few minutes, and the conversation was exactly like that. Like it started on the earth. And then suddenly we were talking about death in the universe and, you know, like weird vibes that you get from about a person who's going to pass away soon. Like, just like he's that kind of a guy. And it really like every aspect of his personality as a rapper came through in a short space. The perfect kind of rap guest verse on a big major label album in that sense.
For the listeners, forgive me if I've told this story on podcast before. Back when I was writing for XXL in the mid-2000s, I waited for Ghostface in the lobby of a Miami like luxury condo for 2 straight days and he never showed up.
Jesus.
It was unreal. Like one of the most absurd, like unreal things that's happened to me in my career. Like I couldn't even get like a manager or a publicist. I couldn't get anybody on the phone. The doorman's looking at me like, what are you doing here? And I swear Ghostface Killah lives here. Like he's going to come down and get me. So anyway, so I had to then come back to New York and then go back to Miami like the next week to do the interview eventually. And he did show up and we had the most cosmically enlightening interview, like a top 5 interview that felt very much in the vein of this verse. And I was touched by this verse because it reminded me of being on whatever penthouse balcony looking over the bay in Miami and him just pure cosmology shit. Just incredible. Anyway, what a special guy. What a just incredible, incredible guy. I hope that feature is good. I don't remember if it's good. I think it's good. Let's talk Kodak. Craig, you had an interesting proposition in your review. Kendrick embracing Kodak, to me, is Kendrick just embracing another rapper he thinks is a great rapper and perhaps someone who he thinks is not fully understood? You actually proposed the idea that maybe they're on a faith journey. I'm curious to hear how seriously you mean that and also, like, tell me more about it.
I wasn't, like, totally serious, but I was like...
I couldn't tell.
What are the chances that like this guy's like understands that it's really deeply provocative to have one of the biggest rappers out on his record? Maybe you know, there are ways that the audience sees rappers that rappers don't see other rappers. And that's always super clear. So I was like, you know, what if these guys just behind the scenes, like really talk about religious stuff and they have sort of similar outlooks. And that's why he's here. And it's not like I'm trying to really like complicate this message for you guys. Like, who's to say that Kendrick has a sense that like this was a bad idea if he's on the record as much as he is? I don't know. Like, it just like it seems like if that's what it was and you're just like, man, they would sure get a rise out of this. Like, that's corny. I hope it's not that.
But, you know, this is where I think the Kendrick discourse about quote unquote cancel culture, this is maybe one of the only places where I think, not that the argument has teeth per se, but if you remember, like, when Spotify was going to pull XXXTentacion off playlist during the R. Kelly moment, one of the only people to push back, and Joe Coscarelli reminded me of this, one of the only people that pushed back was the TDE empire of talking about censorship of music. That was really one of the only celebrity pushbacks that happened in that moment. And it does make me wonder, you know, Craig, I think your point about how audiences see a kind of schism between types of rappers is not ordinarily how it's experienced on the other side. And I think we are all mindful as critics and writers who engage and interface with Twitter and interface with these audiences that perspective is going to shape the reception of certain decisions by musicians.
Yeah, like they're business associates at the end of the day. Like they all work the same conventions kind of thing. Like they're not going to see each other the way we do.
Certainly over the years, I have always been surprised. Like, you know, you'd be in a studio with someone and then like some random person that you would never expect would be friends with that person is just there. And you're like, oh, right. None of the things that are perceived from the outside are actually how it's lived on the inside.
Yeah, like it's dead surprising who knows who. I remember one time I was around Mac, and this became obvious around Mac Miller, and I was like, who just texted, you know, to see who it was, to be like, oh, it's probably somebody crazy. And it was Future, and I was like, okay, I didn't realize that y'all were like boys like that. Like, you know, you never know who talks, and you never know who like sees it for each other low-key and who has like a relationship outside of records, because a lot of people are functionally invisible to us except when they post. I'm pretty sure he just like really respects Kodak as a rapper. There are a lot of people for whom it's that simple. Like the guy just has bars and he has heart, and like that's all they care about.
And also, just like, not to put too fine a point on it, but I think Kodak is someone who has had some challenges in his personal life, has obviously had some legal issues, but also I find when he's really in his like self-reflective penitent bag is among the most affecting writers working, certainly in the last few years.
It could be the Kanye thing where it's like, I want to rehabilitate this guy also.
That's kind of where I was leaning. I mean, I think Craig's case is strong. Like this could just be two lost souls connecting and feeling some affinity. And, you know, also like they're in the same world. And part of the production on here, especially the piano stuff, kind of reminded me of Painting Pictures. So I could, if Kendrick had listened to Painting Pictures, I could see him being like, oh, maybe Kodak would sound good on this. But the other parts of the record are so like inflammatory, like, or not even inflammatory, but like confrontational, prickly, kind of edgy. I don't think you make songs where you're thinking about what R. Kelly's life is like, or like, and like trying to like empathize with R. Kelly and Oprah.
The thing where they threatened to pull the catalog, just knowing that history made the R. Kelly lines hit different for me on this album. I'm not sure if he's as anti as people might make him out to be.
The R. Kelly lines don't feel arbitrary. Like they feel that it comes up twice. Two separate songs, two different contexts. Maybe Kendrick is making the case that, yes, here's R. Kelly, a person who has done evil things, but there's a context in which that person came from that perhaps encouraged or pushed them to behave in terrible ways. Is Kendrick just like radically empathetic? Is it
that's
radical
what he, that's
Christianity?
What he says. I mean, he opens Mother Eyes Sober with, I've always been sensitive. I feel everything. I feel everyone. But I just can't downplay the agency in it. Like he knows what he was doing, and even Kodak knows what he's doing. He says, like, who would have thought I'd become a Kodak? Who'd have thought I'd be here with Kendrick? Like they're both winking at it. And like, even if it is just like them, like, you know, ribbing the crowd, I'm just like, well, you did this and we're gonna have to live with this. I'm gonna have to put this in my review.
I'm going to have to put this in my review. I mean, it's funny. Like, again, I don't mean to laugh, but it's sort of what I was saying before, which is there were at least maybe four or five touch points that before I set one finger on the typewriter that I was like, well, we're going to have to spend a paragraph on this. We're going to have to spend a paragraph on this. We're going to have to spend a paragraph on this. And obviously that's how we're navigating music criticism in this moment. But for every paragraph or every moment that you're spending with that, sometimes I think like there's other things happening on the record that aren't getting as much attention as the kind of headliney things. And that worries me a little bit.
I actually like the Kodak appearances.
Yeah, me too.
I just want to drop that. When I first heard Auntie Diaries, I was like, who said I wanted to write about this? I don't want to discuss this. It was my immediate response just to add to that.
Oh, you didn't want to write about it.
Yeah, no, I was like, I wanted to get out of this without having to talk about that stuff. And now I have to.
Do you think that's possible in the current climate? Do you think that that's at all possible?
I think it would be irresponsible not to treat it with the weight that it deserves, because most people won't care after this week, I imagine.
Jeff, you were saying you like the Kodak appearance. Let's listen. So you're talking Silent Hill, yeah?
Yeah.
Let's listen to a little Silent Hill, Kodak.
I had a survival opportunity. 5% 10 on the wheel, like who was that? Cool take off like it's mad. Beat the with a folk, I'm whipping up super fat. I'm doing scams in the lab. Every Thursday, girls, they spend the time with my daughter, make me go harder. Every Sunday, sons, they teach my boy to be a man. I ain't had no father. Been in love with the block, I ain't had no partner.
I also really like this appearance. I like Kodak. I mean, Kodak's a really impressive rapper.
Well, I also think there's like a weird thing has sort of taken hold in the past couple years of looking through credits, and I feel like it happened with Drake's album, and it's happened a few times where someone would find like an R. Kelly credit or a insert problematic musician. And I feel like it's a very like weird and odd thing to kind of like normalize. And I feel like Kodak Black clearly has a career. He clearly has an audience, and like it's not going to be, I don't know, just in him in and of itself being on the record doesn't seem like a grievous thing. And it also kind of like, the sensibility I got was like being in the church pews and like the bad kid is like on the pulpit, like doing a performance, and you know all the shit they did, but like now they're at church. Like it didn't feel like it was like promoting Kodak Black and any of the like bad things he's done.
Specifically because the record makes a point to talk about treating Black women better. He says this stuff repeatedly. He's drilling this home, and he's got this guy who just last year pleaded to a crazy case. And I don't know if maybe that's just kind of like a performance of imperfection or whatever, like a deliberate artistic decision to be like, while I want to push this message, I also have to consider people who are not all the way along in their journey on this.
I mean, he does have the Jesus crown on.
Yes.
It's ironic, but also he's leading by example. You know, it's like the Julius Caesar refusing the crown kind of thing. Like everybody knows what you mean to the people, and regardless of what title you want to put on it, it's always going to be what it is. I think that he's trying to redirect something that there's no control over. People are always going to look up to him, even in this prickly and I would say often confrontational record. It's being lifted up by a lot of people. It's just one of the greatest things that's happened this year. So like, really, what damage was done to that people look up to him and hang on every word sort of situation, you know?
We're talking about Jesus, which brings me to the last topic that I really want to talk about.
Did not make an appearance on this album, so that's how you know it wasn't a classic.
Wow. That's
okay. The ones that he appears on are the classics and the Kendrick
Jesus was album. Too busy on the NF record to show up for the Kendrick record. Okay. So here's the question that I have for each of you.
No, because some of this stuff could be Lecrae, like a couple of songs.
Yes, absolutely. 100%. Like if you told me that there was like Maverick City Music, like studio musicians, like in the background, I would not be surprised also, you know?
I don't want to maintain some respect on Kendrick's name. Like he's a better rapper than Lecrae.
No, listen, like Lecrae is a talented individual who puts a lot of effort into those records. It is just that there is sometimes when the subject, like that I'm not going to push it. It's a half thought.
No, no, it's okay. We can all acknowledge. We can nod to the didacticism of some of this stuff and just nod at it and then keep walking by. And
the guy to Prince Paul, he's going to hold Lecrae also.
Okay. Yes. Totally fair. So, but is he going to hold Kanye? Now, this is the question I have, and I'm hoping we'll all have different answers to it, but we'll see. Where in the Kanye arc is Kendrick right now?
Wow.
I feel like he's further along than Kanye is.
Like, you think he's post Donda 2?
Yeah. This is like Jesus. I feel like this is a better Donda 2.
This is wow. this is the fatherhood fears and trying to throw the audience record, which is what Jesus was for Kanye.
Okay, so you're saying post Donda 2, Jeff. You're saying Yeezus, Craig. What do you think?
Donda 2, like, the verses are finished. Like, there's songs on this one. There are entire songs on this one.
I kind of don't agree with the question. I feel like it should be, like, where is he at in the Drake arc?
Ooh!
I feel like his beef with Drake, honestly, like, messes up. Like, if Kendrick and Drake would have stayed cool,
But can you imagine, like, what universe
are Kendrick and Drake? What are they arguing
Trump would
over?
Never have been president.
No, like, I know, but literally, what wow. can Kendrick and Drake? This is the thing. Kanye and Drake have things to argue about. Kendrick and Kanye have things to argue about. I struggle to know what Kendrick and Drake truly have to
and
argue
about. And that lasted
about.
For so long. It was, like, this subtle thing that I'm sure they're probably friends.
You have professional frost with people who are good at what they do. And like, also, so are you. And like, you just don't like each other. Like, I have a lot, there's a lot of people like that. Like, that's normal.
Yeah.
But is it real? But like, I don't know, man. These are adults. Like, I'm an adult. Like, I let that go 10, 15 years ago.
Everybody has that one person they simply would never talk to in their industry. And that's what that is. Also, like, just everyone wants to claim the greatest and like, there can't be two at the same time. The catalogs don't match up, though. Like, Drake is like a micro inside my head record kind of guy. And Kendrick is everything outside of my brain.
Yeah, and Drake makes
even
hits.
Even on the therapy record, even we could go through the catalog. Like, okay, Kendrick do have some joints. Like, he has radio hits. There are attempts at hits on this record, contrary to the critical thrust saying otherwise. There's stuff that wants to be seen among the other rappers that are out right now, I think.
Can I propose something? What if this is 808s? Damn is Graduation, the kind of like big, ambitious, like I'm here, I'm present, I can make records of this scale that are going to cross over and touch everybody. And this is what happens when your life falls apart and you realize that when you thought you were at the top, you actually have collapsed fully and there's nothing underneath you except the mountain that you climbed that got kicked out from under you. To me, that's how this scans. And then that makes me wonder.
I don't think we're there yet, though. Like, has he really had like a cataclysmic thing?
Well, based on the snippets of information.
You know, it's like he got found out. Like, we don't know the extent of it. We don't know if he's texting to cheat. We don't know if he's sleeping around. We don't know.
Like, also, there's like, he alludes to like sex addiction, kind of. And yeah, I thought that was
he says lust addiction.
Yeah. More than alludes. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, you know, it's the paper record.
Yeah.
He mostly talks about texting him, I feel like.
Not, first of all, it's the podcast of record and the rules are different. But that makes me wonder, is there on the back end of this a fantasy, like a kind of like fully formed, like, okay, I shook off this whatever. Now I'm going to come back with a fully orchestrated magnum opus that... Yes, I put together this kind of piecemeal, half emotional record with some strange and potentially unacceptable bars, but I'm going to come back with like the full LA Symphony Orchestra, Pink Floyd, The Wall, massive record after this.
I go back and forth between not knowing what to expect and feeling like this was really settling a lot of things and that the next one is going to go in a crazy direction. But that could be just the stuff that you tell yourself when somebody has made the record that isn't necessarily the one that you want.
That you wanted or expected, yeah.
Yeah, or that, you know, it doesn't hit the highs that I needed it to as often as I've expected to from that artist. And maybe like feeling like, oh, like he's going to go crazy the next time is copium, maybe. He really is trying to push things around and change up the art.
Can I ask just like a meta criticism question? Because it's something that was really on my mind as I was writing the review. Because, you know, we'll do critic picks sometimes for really impressive records. And I was like, I don't think I'm going to give this a critic's pick. But I was like, I'm so used to, and Steven, your review is the first Pitchfork review of a Kendrick record since Section 80. That was not Best New Music. I was sort of wondering, like, am I going to be out on a limb here being like, this is an imperfect Kendrick record? But it turns out that everybody felt that way, or almost everybody seemed to feel that way. Was it at all strange to watch that happen in kind of real time? Because I feel like critical discourse sometimes can be blunted and dulled, especially about stars of a certain caliber with a certain expectation. And I was like wondering, kind of like looking at other people's papers a little bit, like, okay, is anybody going to also say this? Or like, well, am I going to be floating out here alone? And then it turned out we all kind of could have just, you know, more or less filed one review because we all mostly thought similar things.
I mean, I don't have any heroes, you know. My
that's right. That's yeah. right.
Like, I
say it louder. Say it with your chest. I mean, say it with your chest.
I listen to the music and I respond to the music. You know, I did have high expectations, but the expectations didn't make the music. I wasn't in the studio. This is just like me hoping it's good. If it's mid, it's mid. You know.
Yeah, like I didn't come in thinking I wanted anything, but I was like, yo, what if we could hear Kendrick talk about XYZ and he wanted to talk about masks and angry tweets. Sometimes, you know, you have to go through that stuff. And there's a lot of people who are in their like hard-headed era and who are in there, I'm rejecting the thing that everybody wants me to do era. And we're getting a lot of like head-ass records because people are pushing back at their, the public perception of themselves in ways that shouldn't matter to them. I get it. But like, come on, it's been 5 years now. Let's get past this. It's not just happening inside the confines of the Kendrick record. And I feel like that we're talking about cancel culture and all that stuff and like deliberate transgressive stuff inside a Kendrick record. It means that this era is so tainted with that mindset that it's even got into like that. I don't know. When do people stop worrying about whoever is not trying to hear what they say and pitch the whole record, pitch the whole show, pitch the whole special, whatever the thing that you're making is, to the people who want to hear it, you know?
It does make me wonder that energy that, oh, they're not ready for this conversation, or I try to have this conversation and they don't want it. Is that kind of like a proxy discourse for, hey, I tried something and for the first time, it's kind of not hitting? So it couldn't possibly be not hitting because it's bad or because it's unappealing. It must be not hitting because of what I'm talking about and because they don't want me to talk about. Like sometimes when you hear Kendrick or like Dave Chappelle or whatever, like griping about something like this, like sometimes I'm just like, maybe the material's not hitting. It doesn't have to do with these other kind of like big picture thematic cancel ideas. Maybe it's more
specific.
They are
isolating in their ranches, in their mansions, in their, you know, beaches, and they are
right
listening to the people who are telling them that they agree with them. And yeah, they're just, everyone's head is just so far up their own. They're like, it's really exquisite to watch every single person go through this.
Every famous rapper from like a certain era,
but it's
right
the political discourse too. Yeah, course, like it's Elon Musk telling people he's going to vote Republican now. Like it's just like, it's everywhere and it's like annoying. And like, I'm very tired of just that whole thread. Now, you can't even call it a thread. It's the whole rope.
To what you're talking about, John, with a lot of the records that have come out, at least in the past 2 years, I think we're really getting a sense of who these people are in the context of not having, you know, a world around them to just like adore them or whatever. So we're all listening to, you know, celebrities in the pandemic where it's like, you know what, like, why can't I say what I want? Why can't I say it? Like, it's like these guys are actually just like rich jerks.
But wait. But there's been some slappers that have come out during the pandemic from the same
rich jerk slappers. Rich jerk slappers.
No, I mean,
that's my new Spotify playlist. I catch my constantly updated Spotify playlist.
I thought I had all this whole Kendrick record was like, what? How funny would it be if like he just got yeet on one track? Just
phenomenal.
And it's like the rap that has blown up, you know, most recently, I feel like is so much closer to where people are. And I think you're hearing a lot of these kind of former stars of the genre start to feel a bit threatened. It's like, does Kendrick have a lot on Yeet at this point? Like, I don't know.
But here's the thing, like that is true. And that's been, I'd say that's been happening since like 2010. But like the Earl Sweatshirt album, also very insular, but really interesting from earlier this year, Sick. That's also like in a very heady space in this like space of reassessment.
I would say so is the Vince record. It's possible to be inside your head and also make records like people are doing it.
Oh, for sure. I think those are two good examples of people who aren't going to be Drake or Kanye.
Ever. Right. But also Vince is someone who also has a less imposed upon moral presentation than Kendrick. Vince has more latitude, I always feel, to navigate than Kendrick seems to have.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But he came ready to rap, though. I feel like I at least respect that.
Well, guys, again, it's a joy to talk Kendrick with three people who will never lose touch. Steven, Jeff, Craig.
Steven, are they cussing you for the Pitchfork review?
Yeah, I have my mutes and filters very established.
I caught 3 days of smoke to Pimp a Butterfly. So, like, just know that it'll always happen. And it's not necessarily just about you. They hate whoever is in the seat.
I appreciate that.
That's real wisdom. I mean, yes. Can confirm. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email me at podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. Subscribe to podcasts. Anywhere you get your audio content. Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Head Separate Media. We will be back next week. Let's go out with some Kendrick incantations on Mirror.
Lately I redirected my point of view. You won't grow.